Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Jill Robbins will bring us this week's education report. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the new coronavirus outbreak has brought attention to a little-known creature, the pangolin. In a recent report, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime says the animal is among the leading suspects that imported COVID-19 from wild bats to people. The agency follows illegal wildlife activity. Pangolins are the size of a small cat to a large dog. Conservation organizations say they are the most heavily illegally traded wild animal in the world. The animals are hunted in Asia and countries near the Sahara Desert in Africa. They are bought and sold illegally, mainly to East Asia, for their scales and meat. The scales are made of keratin, which is also found in human hair and nails. One operation last April seized 25 tons of African pangolin scales, representing an estimated 50,000 dead pangolins, with a market value of some $7 million, UNODC Executive Director Gadawali said. Between 2014 and 2018, the equivalent of 370,000 pangolins were seized globally. There are 8 species of pangolins. Their tongues can be longer than their bodies. 4 species are native to Asia and the other 4 to Africa. All were placed on the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora's protected list in 2016. It is not known how many African pangolins are left in the wild. The UN found that as Asian supplies of pangolins decreased from overhunting, illegal traders have turned to Africa to fill demand. Starting in 2013, West and Central African nations, including Nigeria and Cameroon, were major suppliers of pangolin scales and meat. More recently, Ivory Coast, Guinea, and Liberia have become involved in the illegal trade. The UNODC reported that hunters can earn from $8 to $13 for a small live pangolin and $25 to $30 for a large one. In Uganda, hunters reported catching as many as 20 per day. Once caught, pangolins are placed in hot water or fire to remove their valuable scales. Depending on their size, a pangolin can have up to 1,000 scales. They are dried in the sun and later ground into a powder. That powder is used in Chinese medicine to make a paste believed to help a woman produce breast milk and help with blood flow, among other cures. Pangolin meat is also valued and used in some Asian cooking. Previous outbreaks, like the severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, in 2002, and the Middle East respiratory syndrome, MERS in 2012, started in animals and later spread to humans. Scientists are still looking for the exact source of the current coronavirus outbreak. But conservationists hope that the association with the coronavirus will help to end demand for the endangered pangolin.
Upali Sedra writes about education and serves as an advisor to Sri Lanka's Ministry of Education. He notes that online learning is available to children and adults in many areas, but not others.
One section of the population is enjoying online learning with virtual classrooms, with all kinds of apps, whereas recently the UNESCO indicated a total of 826 million students are kept out of classrooms. And only 43% of these number has access to some form of learning today.
The numbers he gives come from the International Task Force on Teachers, also called the Teachers Task Force. The group is an international alliance of educators and organizations under UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. The divide between the haves and have-nots is very clear in developing countries, especially those south of the Sahara Desert. There, 89% of learners do not have a household computer, and 82% have no internet connection. Some learners have mobile phones where they find information and can connect with their teachers and other learners. About 56 million learners live in places without mobile technology. Half of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. How can young people and adults continue learning in the current coronavirus crisis if they cannot go online? Audrey Azoulay is UNESCO's Director General. She notes the value of other technology, including the use of community radio and television broadcasts, and creativity in all ways of learning. Ahmad Tamim is an online language teacher in Kabul, Afghanistan. He notes that the Afghan National Television is broadcasting educational programs for students who are not able to attend school. They are staying at home to protect themselves and others from the coronavirus. Since internet access in Afghanistan is costly, Tamim noted, few students can spend much time learning online. He heard that some teachers are using phone apps to send study materials to students. He said that he does not believe online learning will continue after the coronavirus pandemic ends, because students enjoy the social contacts and friendships they make at school. Martha Young is Director of Educational Programs at the Professional Development Institute of the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul. She spoke with principals of private Afghan schools where all the subjects are taught in English. She found only one who was sure that every student has a computer at home. Afghanistan's public education system teaches children from kindergarten through high school. These public schools are not attempting online learning. Young notes that some universities are trying to support online learning programs, but it has become nearly impossible for them to continue because of Taliban attacks on power stations in and around Kabul. Before the attacks, each neighborhood received enough power for only 4 hours a day. Now electricity is available for even shorter periods. James Onyango is an education officer with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. He helps educators working in the Rohingya refugee camps at Cox's Bazar. Onyango says these educators have developed some guidelines to support caregivers and parents in facilitating some learning in their homes while the facilities remained closed. He told VOA that the UNHCR acknowledges that parents cannot take the place of teachers for their children.
We're not trying to convert the households into schools.
Instead, he said, the UN agency's guidance is more about general ideas for what a parent can do.
For instance, encouraging the parents to try and assist their child to spend between 1 to 2 hours per day on education using the workbooks that they had been provided. If they could identify an adult who is in their household who could work with these children for between 1 to 2 hours in a day in the home.
Helping children with their workbooks requires an adult who can read. Onyango said, the ability to read, while important, is not always the only way to help children learn.
In terms of the younger children, we are encouraging the parents to tell them stories or play with them, just as a way of ensuring that during this period, children are meaningfully engaged. It also has a positive effect in terms of further facilitating the desired social distancing.
The teachers who live in the refugee camps help to pass information along to families in their neighborhoods using megaphones. Islamic clergymen have been sharing information in messages broadcast from religious centers. In some areas, large signs are hung where people can see them. Education writer Upali Sedra spoke with VOA about conditions in Sri Lanka.
The Statistical Department of Sri Lanka has done a household survey that indicates only 24% of our homes got a computer at home, particularly the digital literacy. You know, somebody is able to use social media, the Facebook and things like that. About 78% of the youth can use it, but not necessarily computer literacy. Ability to do something with the computer is much lower than that. It's about 43% in general.
Even families who have a computer or a mobile device may not be able to use it for online learning. Sedra said the less costly service plans they have do not offer them enough data for learning online.
The internet access in Sri Lanka is very low. I think about the 27% of the rural population, 46% to 50% in the urban societies, you get internet facility at home.
The solution to distance learning for Sri Lanka may be found in existing technology. The country's president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, has asked educators to use television, or TV, more as a teaching tool. Through a deal between the Sri Lankan Ministry of Education and Voice of America, learning English videos are now shown daily on Channel I, one of two national TV broadcasters. I'm Jill Robbins.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. He was a popular and successful president who was re-elected in 1996. But he also became only the second president in American history ever to be put on trial in Congress. Clinton's past in Arkansas became the source of accusations and questions about his character as he was running for president. These included questions about financial dealings with a land development company called Whitewater. In January of 1994, President Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent lawyer to lead an investigation. She named a Republican, but some critics said her choice was too friendly to the Clinton administration. He was replaced by another Republican, Kenneth Starr. In 1995, the Senate Judiciary Committee began its own investigation of the president. The committee later reported that it had not found evidence of any crimes. However, because the committee was led by Democrats, there was continuing suspicion of the president among Republicans. The main cause of that suspicion dated back to a purchase of land in Arkansas years earlier. Bill and Hillary Clinton had bought the land in 1978, the year he was first elected governor of that state. The Clintons formed the Whitewater Development Company with Susan and James McDougal. The goal was to sell vacation homes along a river. However, the company did poorly. James McDougal also owned Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan, for which Hillary Clinton did legal work. Madison failed during the 1980s. The McDougals were found guilty of wrongdoing in connection with that failure. A former local judge in Little Rock, the state capital, also became part of the story. In 1994, David Hale pleaded guilty to charges of cheating the federal government. That case was in connection with a lending company he owned and was not connected to Whitewater. But Hale accused Bill Clinton of having pressured him while governor to loan money to Susan McDougal and other politically influential people. Clinton denied the accusations. During the president's first term, investigators sought billing records for Hillary Clinton's past legal work for James McDougal. They wanted to know, in connection with the Whitewater investigation, how much time she had spent on that work. The First Lady said she could not find the records. Then, in January of 1996, the billing records appeared without explanation in the White House. That mystery only added to the suspicions of some Americans. Others thought Kenneth Starr was just wasting taxpayer money on his investigation of the Clintons. They felt it was just for political reasons. The Whitewater investigation became increasingly complex and difficult to follow. In the end, President Clinton was never charged with any wrongdoing in connection with his financial dealings. But his legal problems did not stop there. In 1994, a former Arkansas state employee named Paula Jones sued President Clinton. She brought a civil action accusing him of sexual harassment while governor of Arkansas. In her lawsuit, she said he had asked her for sex. A federal judge dismissed her case for lack of evidence. Paula Jones appealed that ruling. Her lawyers said they wanted to prove that Clinton had a pattern of such behavior with female employees, including while president. They suspected that these included a 21-year-old woman named Monica Lewinsky. Lewinsky had worked as an unpaid intern in the White House. Kenneth Starr was still investigating the Whitewater case early in 1998. He received permission to include Lewinsky in his investigation.
Hi, how'd you know it was me?
Same caller ID.
Oh, what's it say?
Linda Tripp.
A former friend of Monica Lewinsky, Linda Tripp, had given Starr tape recordings of her telephone conversations with the younger woman.
I hate him.
No, you don't.
You hate his behavior at times.
In the recordings, Lewinsky talked about her relationship with the president. What she told Linda Tripp conflicted with the information she gave to lawyers for Paula Jones. She had told them that the relationship had not been sexual. Lawyers for Paula Jones also questioned President Clinton. He, too, denied that the relationship with Monica Lewinsky had been sexual. On January 26, 1998, the president stated his denial to the American public.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie. Not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
Later in the year, the president agreed to answer questions before a federal grand jury.
The opening statement I made is that I had inappropriate intimate contact. I take full responsibility for it. It wasn't her fault, it was mine. I do not believe that I violated the definition of sexual relations I was given by directly touching those parts of her body with the intent to arouse or gratify. And that's all I have to say.
This was the first time an investigating jury had ever called a president to testify while in office.
This afternoon in this room, from this chair, I testified before the Office of Independent Counsel and the grand jury. I answered their questions truthfully, including questions about my private life, questions no American citizen would ever want to answer. Still, I must take complete responsibility for all my actions, both public and private. And that is why I'm speaking to you tonight.
After his appearance, the president went on national television and admitted the nature of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky.
As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong.
He said his actions were a personal failure, but he denied trying to get her to lie about the relationship.
But I told the grand jury today, and I say to you now, that at no time did I ask anyone to lie, to hide or destroy evidence, or to take any other unlawful action. I know that my public comments and my silence about this matter gave a false impression. I misled people, including even my wife. I deeply regret that.
Kenneth Starr sent his final report to the House of Representatives. The report suggested that President Clinton may have committed impeachable crimes in trying to hide his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. In the United States, to impeach a president means to bring charges in the House of Representatives. The charges result in removal from office if the president is found guilty in a trial in the Senate. The Chief Justice of the United States serves as the judge, and the senators serve as the jury. In December of 1998, the House of Representatives voted to impeach President Clinton. The House sent the charges to the Senate to hold a trial. The two articles of impeachment accused him of lying to a federal grand jury and obstructing justice. Only one other president had ever been impeached. In 1868, the House of Representatives brought charges against Andrew Johnson. The case related to his removal of a cabinet member. The Senate held a trial, but Andrew Johnson's presidency survived by one vote. The threat of impeachment led President Richard Nixon to resign in 1974 over his cover-up of political wrongdoing in the Watergate case.
It is up to the members of the House of Representatives to vote their conscience on the Constitution and the law, which I believe are clear, and I have no intention of resigning. It's never crossed my mind.
Bill Clinton still had 2 years left as president. In public opinion surveys, two-thirds of the people said they opposed removing him from office.
What I want the American people to know, what I want the Congress to know, is that I am profoundly sorry for all I have done wrong in words and deeds. I never should have misled the country, the Congress, my friends, or my family. Quite simply, I gave in to my shame. I have been condemned by my accusers with harsh words. And while it's hard to hear yourself called deceitful and manipulative, I remember Ben Franklin's admonition that our critics are our friends, for they do show us our faults.
The Senate decided President Clinton's future in February of 1999. The 100 senators held a trial to consider the charges and decide if he should be removed from office. Each charge required 67 votes to find him guilty. 10 members of the Republican majority joined Democrats in voting to clear Clinton of the perjury charge. The Senate was evenly divided on the charge of interfering with justice, thus no guilty verdict. Bill Clinton remained president of the United States. As a historical footnote, as it turned out, Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich was himself cheating on his wife while leading the impeachment action against President Clinton. The difference, Gingrich would say years later, was that Clinton was charged with lying after he legally swore to tell the truth. In October 1999, Kenneth Starr resigned as the independent counsel. An assistant, Robert Ray, completed a final report on the Whitewater investigation. He issued his report in September 2000. The report said there was not enough evidence to prove any wrongdoing by Bill or Hillary Clinton.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.